Lord of all hopefulness, Lord of all joy, whose trust ever childlike no cares could destroy. Let's sit. The 1943 classic Little Prince begins with the story of a pilot who is reflecting back on his childhood, a childhood that included the early indications of a vocation as an artist. Now, as a child, he drew what he referred to as picture number one. It's a picture that, from the side, looked a little bit like a flat-brimmed cowboy hat, right? If you just looked at it, looked a little bit like a cowboy hat. And he presented this picture number one to the grown-ups in his life. And they said, well, that's good for you. I mean, what a great hat you've drawn. To which he says, in all exasperation, well, that's not a hat at all. That's a snake that's eaten a giant critter. So he says, let me show you. So he draws picture number two. Capital N, capital T. Picture number two. And it's in picture number two that you can then see the dissected hat. You can see the flesh of the snake wrapped around an elephant standing sideways, trunk out. And he says, see, I told you all along that what I've drawn here was a snake that has eaten a giant critter. The grown-ups around him said, as grown-ups do, you should consider a new vocation. Right? You should do anything other than art. Anything. You should do grown-up things like study math and study the sciences, right? You should study your history, right? Stick to those sorts of things. Get better at politics. And we're told that this pilot, reflecting back on his youth, took that into consideration and decided, yeah, maybe that's the best course of action. I'm going to prepare myself for the world that the grown-ups have told me is the world. Capital T, capital W. The world. I'm going to lay aside the arts. I'm going to set aside my imagination, and I'm going to study the hard stuff. Now, being a rebel, this pilot folded up picture number one and stuck it in his pocket so that forever, when he imagined the possibility of building a relationship with someone else around him, he could test them. And he would test them by pulling out picture number one, and he'd slide it over to them. He'd say, what do you think? And those who saw a hat, he would fold it up, put it away, turn, and walk. Those, however, who saw the snake eating a critter, he would engage. He knew that there was something here that he could work with, right? They shared a worldview. And it's possible to imagine that sharing a worldview meant that they maybe shared a heart, right? He could do that. Now, he's reflecting on this childhood experience having just crashed in the Saharan desert. And he wakes up one morning to find next to him this little prince. And he shakes his eye, rubs his eyes. He said, what in the world? And the little prince, first thing out of his words, this is like my son who used to say he'd wait for us waking up and he'd start with a big sentence and it would shock us. This little prince says to the pilot when he wakes up, hey, I need you to draw me a sheep. What? I need you to draw me a sheep. Now, this pilot, formerly an artist, now more interested in things like geography, because it's helpful as a pilot, he hearkens back to his artistic skills and he draws up his first sheep. And it's awful. You can see it right there in the book. It's one of the worst sheep you've ever seen. And the prince says, no, I want you to draw me a sheep So he draws a second sheep. It's only barely better than the first one. Prince again, more and more exasperated, says, no, no, no. What I asked for was a sheep. I need you to draw me a sheep. To which the pilot, hearkening back to the depths of his soul, that deep vocation, God-given, draws a box. And he puts little air holes in it. And he slides it over to the prince, to which the prince says, that is the most magnificent sheep I have ever seen. That is the sheep I've been waiting for. Thus begins their relationship. They share a heart, they share an imagination, share a worldview, perhaps. They become fast friends. And having established this notion that they see the world the same way, through the same set of lenses, which comes from deep within their soul, it's that primordial thing that's God-given, that imagination that we're given to imagine possibilities greater than the present circumstance, the stuff the grown-ups don't get. Knowing that they share that in common, that it's still alive for the two of them, they become fast friends, and thus begins the lesson of life in the world when that's your worldview. Having agreed to that, the justice work begins, right? The tending of the garden, the digging up of the baobabs. There's a playfulness to this kind of imagination, right? There's a playfulness to being able to interpret what's happening in the world around us from that part of us that hasn't sort of been sort of driven into the hard sciences that are primarily interested in empiricism, those things that are possible and impossible, and there's a clear bifurcation, right? If it's not measurable, it's not worthy. If it doesn't move us directly from point A to point B, if it's not transferable, right, in a playbook, that it's not worthy. There's a playfulness in this kind of world transformation that many of us have lost, right? And if we're paying attention to what's happening in the world around us right now, we've mostly lost the playfulness. Am I right? I don't know about you, but that was the most exhausting vacation I've ever had. Emotionally. Awful. Ed Friedman, the great organizational consultant who transferred Murray Bowen's family systems thinking into faith communities and then writ large into societies, he suggests that when we find ourselves in the midst of anxious times, in the midst of tense times, when conflict is all that we see, that the first thing to go is our playfulness, right? You know that a system's in trouble when it stops playing, right? For sure. That's the tree frog. That's the honeybee. That's the butterfly that goes away when we're sick. When we're sick, the playfulness goes away and the joy with it. The sheer joy of being alive goes with it. And then we sort of hunker down, and it's just, how do I get through today, and how do I get through tomorrow? I can't even imagine a step beyond our present circumstances because we feel stuck, right? There's nothing outside of us inspiring us and pulling us to something greater than just trying to fight our way through the day, right? And when we're anxious, that's where we spend a lot of our time. And if you're paying attention to what's happening around us, the discourse is flat. It's clearly bifurcated. I don't hear a lot of joy in it. I don't feel any playfulness. This has happened before, right? I know we like to feel exceptional, but this has happened before, right? This happens all the time. We get stuck, we fall flat, we lose our joy, we stop playing. Life's meaning is hidden often. And I think that's the same dynamic that Jesus shows up to in the gospel today. Right? There's conflict. Division is the real thing. He's not just going to make it happen. It's happening. And it's happening for a lot of right reasons. Those who've been left out are demanding their place at the table. Those who've been hungry are demanding to be fed. Those who have been squashed are demanding to stand upright. So the conflict is happening for a lot of good reasons. And the resistance is predictable, right? So we get the argument and the counter-argument. It's just the nature of things. That's how justice works. The Marxists had it right. It's dialectical. It's not a straight line at all. So conflict is normative. And the question is, what do the people of faith do in the midst of that conflict, which is normative, seasonal even? How do we, as the people of God, show up in the midst of that and offer something to it? How do we show up in the midst of it and not simply pick a side? How do we either not opt out or choose that what we're really going to do is just join the empire, as many of our brothers and sisters of the faith have chosen to do, is say, you know what, the best we can do right now is join the empire. Just keep your head down, do what they say, go with it. Some folks are going to get beat up in it, but we should be fine if we join the empire. And it's important to remember, this has happened before. You ever hear the prophets beat up on the kings of Israel and Judah? Any idea why? Joining the empire is not our vocation. That's what the grown-ups do, those who've given up. They study the hard stuff, the pragmatic and practical. It's about self-preservation, covering my own tail. But what the kids do, what those of us do who still have a living imagination within us, who are still inspired by the Holy Spirit, who still aspire to the vision of the kingdom that God has given us as a promise, those folks do something else. They don't opt out. They don't fully opt in. But, as Ed Friedman says, they're in the midst of it. Well differentiated, claiming their right to joy, to playfulness, to a living imagination that says that God's promises are not simply ancient fantasy, but that God's promises are living and real, and they're present to us. And some people can see it, and some people can't. Some will see hats, some will see snakes eating giant critters. And you'll know who you're working with depending on what they see and how they see. And so I wonder if it isn't what Jesus is showing up to today. He says, great that you've got the hard sciences. You've got that grown-up capacity to know what's going on with the weather. I mean, that's going to serve you well in a lot of ways. That's great. It'll get you from today to tomorrow. But how come no one among you can interpret the present time? How come none among you is living as if you're up above the fray, hopeful, imaginative, playful, joyful? There's nothing different about you than the society around you. How come that is? I think that's the Jesus challenge to us today. How come you cannot interpret the present time? Have we given up on the vision? Have we squashed it deep down under the practicalities of just trying to make it through today and tomorrow and the next day? Have we decided it's better just to hunker down and circle the wagons and save our own tails rather than proclaim and embody the vision that says everybody is in it? That is to say, we live or die together. Faith communities come together for a specific reason. Faith communities come together because we have this story about God's dream for the world. And again, many of us come together because we believe that it is more than just ancient fantasy. We come together because we believe that it is the real. It is the true, capital T, capital T. It is the most real thing in the world, God's vision. And we receive it and we bear it and we proclaim it. We cultivate it and embody it as a promise. We commit to be citizens of that kingdom, not simply folks who've given up in the midst of these kingdoms and of our own empire within it. We're supposed to be different. We're counterculture. And we know that we're fighting against all the pressures in the world to squash that. There's all sorts of reasons to give up hope. There's all sorts of reasons to feel helpless. And truth be told, even the good stuff, there's all sorts of reasons to say, I'm too busy, tending a broken heart. I can't bear it. I'm going to go out and be as busy as possible. And I'm going to busy myself, not just with kind of awful things, but once in a while, I'm going to go busy myself with some really good stuff. I'm just going to be so busy that I forget about my heartbreak. And when that happens, I think that's when exhaustion sets in. When the denial of the reality that our tanks are empty, that we've actually given up hope, and that though we're doing good work, it's just our practical response to a world that feels like it's crushing us. And so once in a while, the people of faith are asked to gather around our story again. We're asked to just take a break. There's a reason in the constitution of our creation narrative that Sabbath is there. Sabbath is there because we need it. God has built it into us to need it. And we need it because that's where we cultivate hope. So little faith communities like this all over the world come together, and that's exactly what we do. We cultivate hope. We remind ourselves of that kid deep down inside each one of us that understood the power of those evocative images of milk and honey and of sheep and wolves and of the desire that everyone's got a spot at the table. And we have to tap into that. And we have to remember that that is not only valid, but that is all that is valid for people of faith. That is the reality. And we know that it takes work to be a counterculture, particularly in a culture so full of inhumanity, so full of utter devastation. But we know this has happened before. We know that people of faith have shown up and have made a difference. And I think, as it's been said somewhere else, I can't quite remember who, the good news is that there's a people for that, right? You know the rest of this? And the bad news is that it's us? Yeah. We don't have to just be the grown-ups. We can be the kids who believe it again. We come together to church to tend to word and sacrament. We hear amazing things said about the nature of the world, and we remind ourselves of them on a regular basis. The anamnesis that will be said from the table that says, God, you've done all these things in the past. You're doing them in the present. And if we can in any way contribute to those things happening in the future, please give us the grace and the strength to do so. We hear magnificent things under this roof about what God's up to in the world. And we're invited every single time we hear those things to offer ourselves to participate in it. We do that on a regular basis. And many of us practice something like a rule of life where we commit on a regular basis to set ourselves in the presence of God, to pray. We commit ourselves on a regular basis to know the stories, to remember what that little critter inside the snake looks like in our heads, to commit ourselves to it again, to feel like we don't have to fold it up and stick it in our pocket. So we learn on a regular basis. We fill our imaginations. We strengthen them. And we learn how it is to care for the concerns of one another, for our closest neighbors, for the folks around us in the community, for people all around the globe. We practice praying, we practice learning, and we practice serving. And here at this cathedral, our little resistance movement is to practice that with some intention because we think it makes a difference, right? We talk about it in a Benedictine framework, that Saint Benedict, in the midst of the tail end of the downfall of the empire, said, you know what, the best thing we can do is remember the promises God has given us and recommit ourselves to those things and do it in small, intimate ways by praying together and learning together and serving each other's cares and concerns. That is what will change the world. Joan Chittister says this, quietly and calmly, Saint Benedict says it all when he writes, keep this little rule that we have written for beginners. The most profound of spiritual insights may well be this one, that we are all beginners who every day, as the desert masters have taught us, must make a new beginning. Every day. It is the willingness, it is the heart to start over every day that leads in the end to God. We must start again and again and again to build community in a world of difference, to live simply in a world of excess, to live close to the soft heart of Jesus in a world where power and where force are the spirit of the times. To sink humbly into the heart of God in a world where the self is more readily worshiped. That will free us to be happy, to be peaceful, to be the lovers of life that God has made each one of us to be. Indeed, friends, like that pilot, like that little prince, let us daily keep this little rule for beginners and keep our hearts on fire, our imaginations filled with hope. Amen.